And what's up, podcast people and soundtrack geniuses around the world? You're listening to The Soundcast, and on this podcast, we talk all things film, television, and video game music. I am Christopher Coleman, and joining me today is...
Eric Woods from Cinematic Sound Radio.
And I'm Dane Walker.
Today is Wednesday, August 7th, 2019, and this is episode 144 of the Soundcast 6, volume 15, where we talk about six of the most compelling recent topics from the world of soundtracks.
You can find all episodes of the Soundcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher Radio, Radio Public, Google Podcasts, and you can send us your feedback at soundcast@tracksounds.com, or you can use our SpeakPipe widget, which is really cool, and you should do that. Or you can reach us on Twitter at AudioSoundcast.
Well, welcome, Eric and Dane. How are you guys doing?
Good.
I'm all right.
Good deal.
Are great to be back.
It's good to have you back. It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. Long while. You guys keep watching these recent movies and wanting to discuss them.
We're crazy.
Can't you just wait
like
for
that.
It to come out on Blu-ray?
We're weird like that.
Some of them I wish I could have waited to.
Yeah, that's right. Spend the $4.99 rental fee instead of the $499.
Well, I think we're in wait for video season now. I think officially we've entered that season. Well, tonight we're going to be doing a Soundcast 6 episode, as you heard in the intro. We're going to be talking about six topics, and those six topics are... composer Dan Romer being added to the Bond 25 crew. We're going to discuss the results from a Twitter poll that I did on which people preferred which Lion King score did they prefer. He threw me off.
It's the circle of life.
It kind of is. He heard lion. He's like, where? We're going to be talking about the Twitter poll that I did comparing the two, the Lion King 1994 with the Lion King 2019, which version of the score did people prefer? The third story is we're going to talk about this semi-recent trend of composers doing public pitches for potential projects. We're going to bring up a few examples of that. If you don't know what I mean by that, stay tuned. Then we're going to talk about another poll that I did even further back, asking which score people were more anticipating from the Phase 4 of the MCU, the Black Widow score or the Eternal score, even though we don't know who's scoring them yet. So purely based on the movie itself and what that might offer us. The fifth story is one about composer Alf Clausen, who is suing over being fired on The Simpsons, from The Simpsons. That happened last year. And the last news item is we're going to react to the recent release of Hans Zimmer's Experiments from Dark Phoenix soundtrack release. I guess you could call it a soundtrack release. So those are our six topics, and we're going to dive right in to topic number one. If you don't know, the way this works is we go through each topic. We get 10 minutes per topic. When 10 minutes runs up, Dane will let us know. We have to stop and move on to the next topic at that point. If we finish discussing a topic early, we get to save whatever amount of time we didn't use and bag it to use somewhere else where we might be a little more long-winded. So Dane's going to be manning the timer tonight in Kristen's absence. Dane, are you ready with the timer?
I'm ready. I've taped a label over my phone calling it The Kristen. Okay. In honor of Kristen.
Okay.
So it's ready now. It feels more ready to do this now.
Okay.
Are you ready?
I'm glad to hear it. Yes. We're going to get started with topic number one, which is the announcement of composer Dan Romer, who's going to be writing the original score for the next James Bond film. And this was several weeks ago, right, Eric, when this came out? I can't remember exactly when that...
I'm trying to think. It was like a month and a half ago.
July 2nd, 2019. IndieWire is one place that broke the story. Dan Romer. Not the first name that probably comes to people's minds when they're thinking about James Bond. What do you think of this decision, Eric?
Really not a fan of it one bit. I think the only positive aspect is that the composer and director know each other, but this this feels like Eric Serra on GoldenEye, where they, it's not necessarily the, a similar style, but it's where they brought in an experimental composer.
Mm-hmm.
And he's coming into a series where the style just doesn't work at all. But I mean, again, who's saying that James Bond has to be the same thing,
right?
Over the course of 25 films.
Sure.
But, I think there's a particular sound and style that, that Bond fans like, and that's that kind of John Barry, David Arnold sound.
Mm-hmm.
But being familiar with Romer's style, I don't think it fits with this series at all. Unless the film goes for a more atmospheric character based, type of story. Cause most of Romer's music is in that vein, atmospheric, ethereal, kind of, these floating cues that kind of just go through a scene instead of really complementing specifics. From the action music I have heard, it is very similar to Thomas Newman and what he did on his two Bond features. A lot of people have been pointing to Far Cry 5 mm-hmm. as why he would be a perfect fit for Bond. And yeah, he can write a few groovy action cues, but it starts to get really stale after a while and doesn't really lack a lot of personality. So I'm not sure what to think. Again, I think we have to really understand what type of film they're going to be making.
Yeah.
And if they are going for something a little bit more, you know, character based without a lot of action, which I'm not sure how interesting that would be.
It's James Bond.
But I'm still expecting Lauren Balfe to be the replacement composer at the last second.
You might be right.
Yeah.
Dane, what do you think about this?
Well, I'm one of these, you know, David Arnold fans. Every time a new Bond movie's out, I'm like, yeah, David Arnold's coming back, rock on. And he never does.
Yeah, I've been saying that for a while then.
And I'm sad about that. But, you know, I haven't heard any of Dan Romer's music, and I know Eric provided a link, but I didn't have time to go listen to that before we came on. I think there's a couple of things that make me think, I mean, I'm nervous about it because I've never heard his music, but there's a couple of things that, that make me feel okay about. One, it's a good production house. It's a good group that's going after this to do this film. So I don't think they're going to make a stupid decision. I don't think it's just a like, oh, let's just get Dan to do it, you know, kind of thing. I think they know exactly who they, I think they picked him on purpose. I think they have a reason that they want him to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And as we'll discuss in another section of the Soundcast today, he probably pitched for it. So he's written something that convinced them that they, that he can do it.
Mm.
And then, one question I did have, does he mostly do video games? Is that his?
Nope.
No. Okay.
He's done a lot of Netflix like stuff.
Beast of the Southern Wild.
Yeah. Beast of Donations.
Okay. Yeah. A lot of people like him.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
It's just I wouldn't be picking him for Bond.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just wondering if perhaps the things he's scored, they've required him to write the kinds of scores you're hearing.
Sure.
And yeah. And maybe this is his, he can prove that he can do the other stuff.
Yeah.
You know, maybe he's going to be able to do that. So, and especially since you said he did, it sounded like, some of Thomas Newman's work.
The action stuff sounds like it.
Okay.
Like what Newman did with Bond. Mm-hmm. Cause Newman can do all kinds of different types of action music.
Sure. Sure.
But it sounds like the last two movies that Daniel Craig was in. So
okay.
I guess they wanted to continue with that style. Well, and maybe
they've
decided
they got to continue. Right.
And that would be probably the reasoning behind it.
Right. And then the only other thing I thought was they're going to do something new in this, mm-hmm. which is introduce the female Bond.
Yeah.
And with that, perhaps they're saying, let's introduce a new sort of musical touch to this that can go on to the next film.
Yeah, that could very well be so. In looking at the things that he's done, looking back at them, I really don't hear much in there that's like, okay, yeah, I can see why they picked him. If it's going to be like any James Bond we've seen before, including the most recent. I mean, the stuff, he does like really sparse, not Far Cry withstanding. That's kind of in your face in a lot of ways. Lots of, you know, kind of country guitar-y, and it's like, that's not James Bond. There's a show on Netflix now called The Innocent Man, and the score there is a small orchestra, pretty dark, very pensive, very atmospheric. Like, if that's the direction they're going with James Bond, I guess. He did a score for Cary Fukunaga's miniseries on Netflix, too, called Maniac, which Cary Fukunaga is the director of this. But that's like almost the opposite. It's super plucky and small and percussive and chromatic, and it's like the exact opposite of what you hear in Innocent Man. So I'm like, wow, it's all over the place. He did the score for the show Easy, which I think was on Netflix too. The first season, it's beautiful. It's small chamber orchestra. It's super, super beautiful. So I'm going through and listening to these, and I'm like, this guy's very talented. He's got a very diverse palette. So that bodes well. But there's just nothing in there that's like, okay, I can see how that can be. How that could work with a Bond movie, unless the tone of Bond is going to radically change, which it could. It would shock me if it did, because it's like, it's Bond 25. Maybe we go out on a high note with what people are expecting for a James Bond film. And then with Bond 26, you move into your new direction. We kind of have some experience with people changing things in the middle, in midstream, when people are not expecting a change midstream, and that doesn't always go so well. And the Bond fans are pretty old school, hardcore. They're already freaking out about the potential change in character. You know, it's like, what are you doing? If that's what's happening, why are you doing this? Because you know what's going to happen. So maybe there's a radical change in place or coming, and his style is going to fit completely. That's the only way I see it working, to be honest. I mean, but then he is talented, so maybe he can put on his John Barry, David Arnold hat. Maybe.
He's got to hit the horns like nobody's business.
Well, sure.
Sure.
And none of his scores do.
And maybe he hasn't been given the opportunity.
It's true.
Right.
It's true. It's absolutely true. But, you know, I was just thinking, as preparing for this particular story, you know, on the Annotator this week, we have the score for Blood and Truth. I don't know if you guys have listened to it, but Joe Thwaites and Jim Fowler have done an excellent score that's modernized. It's brass plus grime. And,
nice.
And it's like, if you want to go with a modern sound for James Bond, I mean, the brass is just blasting in that score. And there are moments that are very Don Davis Matrix-like. And their goal was to capture the sound of London. That's what they were looking to go for. And I'm thinking, man, this is modern day Bond music if you wanted it to be.
Nice.
So if you guys haven't listened to that episode, check it out. If not, or skip the episode and just look up Blood and Truth on Spotify or wherever and have a listen to the score. It gets pretty hardcore grime in there, but I like that sound. But mixing it with just hardcore brass is just a fantastic combination.
Always.
And so it's like, man, why couldn't they go in that sort of direction? And maybe they will with Dan Romer. Who knows? But I think we're in for something different. I'd be surprised if he does something like anyone's done in the past. It's like, if they're going to do that, why bring him on? So I'm at least interested to see what he does. Don't know if I like it or not, but I'm interested. Oh, is that the bell? That's the bell.
Ooh, that's new.
Yes.
I'm surprised you didn't write something for this.
I didn't have time.
Come on, the track sound theme.
This is how my kids learned that they have to have eaten by then.
Oh, really? Wow.
Now they're outside the door wondering what's going on.
They're like Pavlov dog. Like, I ate it all. Should I be done my food by now? I'm done. I told you I was done. It's like the opposite of Pavlov's dog. They like get full when they hear that. I can't eat anymore.
If only that worked, I would be playing it all the time. Stop eating.
All right. Let's go on to topic number two, which is the King of the Lion King poll. So about a week ago, July 29th, I did a Twitter poll asking which version of the Lion King original score by Hans Zimmer do you prefer, not considering the songs by any of the artists, just the score. And you had two choices, Lion King 1994, Lion King 2019, and the winner by a long shot was 1994 at 76% to 24% of the Lion King. That's from 233 votes. So my question to you two is, were you surprised by the disparity in the voting? Eric, were you surprised by how much the Lion King 1994 "quote unquote," one.
No. And the way I see it is, I mean, a lot of film music fans, especially, they love their originals, and any type of re-recording or anything new or new adaptation of something that is very familiar doesn't really work for them. Mm. I do love re-recordings. I love new interpretations of film scores and whatnot. But I could see that, one, nostalgia, and two, they just hate the movie, the 2019 version, and are going to pick 1994 every single time. So I'm not sure whether some of those votes were even music-based. It was just more on, we hate the new movie. Mm. So, but I wasn't surprised. Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
Eric, what about you? Not Eric. Dane, what about you?
I don't know. I was kind of surprised. I think the reason I was surprised was just because the presentation of this current version is just, well, it's just so different, but it presents his music in a more mature, more warm way. The mix is really warm. It's got wider definition, a lot more clarity to me. It's just more live. It's more, I don't know. It's just awesome to have Hans get to redo something he did, 20 some odd years ago. And it's impressive. So I didn't know if they were making a musical choice. They might say this one's better, because if you really go back and listen to the old one, it's a little colder. It's a little pushed into the distance in the recording. It's just not as, it's not as quality as this one. However, that being said, it's freaking nostalgically awesome. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. So if the nostalgia wins, which Eric is pointing out, nostalgia wins every time. How many of us like those original Star Wars recordings as opposed to, the new Sony releases, etc.? Eric's got his hand up.
The old ones by a million.
Oh yeah, I mean, they're just miles. There's just something to them. I don't know. I would have thought it would have been more 50-50. Mm-hmm. I do like this new recording though. I really do.
Yeah. I thought it was going to be much closer. I thought it was going to be 60-40 and 50-50 at worst, but I thought it'd be more like 60-40. I thought just recency bias was going to bring people into voting for 2019, the Twitter crowd. I just thought they were going to be maybe a little younger, maybe. And so, oh yeah, I love the new one, but not hardly. Let me read a couple of the comments, tweets that came in. Scott Buckley At Music Scientific says, I hate to say it, but I think the new one does sound better. So tough to compare, though. At Gift Heck says, 1994 edges it for me, but 2019 is a beautiful compliment to it. So most of the people who replied had something positive to say about 2019. At NTNBC says, depends on the track for me. Stampede sounds better, mixed and more impactful in 2019 version. However, the new Remember Who You Are doesn't reach the same level of apotheosis of the 1994 version. The songs are vastly inferior. I have to agree that much of 2019 sounds, quote unquote, better, clearer. The vocals are much clearer. But in the end, I found that off-putting, because I'm so used to the other, and that mm-hmm. mix and everything. And so it all just sounds like, it just is a constant reminder of, this is a remake of something that was already done before with every note. And it's just, even though it sounds better, and that, I guess that's just nostalgia and humanity kicking in. The original release only had 42 minutes of score. And the new one, well, 42 minutes total, including the songs. And the new one has like an hour and 17 minutes. And there's lots of songs, new songs too, on the new release. But just listening through, I enjoy the, if I just skip all the songs and listen to the score tracks, I enjoy the listening experience of the original better. The order of the tracks, the lengths of the tracks, all of that. And again, that might just mm-hmm. be because I'm so used to it speaking. But I do prefer the listening experience of the first one with inferior recording and all. It feels more, it doesn't feel like it's wasting time at any point in time. Whereas the new one, sometimes it does feel that way. I don't know why I feel that exactly, but it just feels like, okay, let's get on to the next bit of music that's going to really engage me. Yeah, any other thoughts about it? I mean, I really did think it was going to be a closer vote, but maybe the Twitter audience is older than I think it is.
Have you listened to the Legacy release of The Lion King?
The Legacy
release? The expanded complete release?
I don't think
that came out a few years
ago. You're talking about that one where they released all the scores in that Legacy.
Oh, yeah. So like Cinderella, the Beauty and the Beast and whatnot.
Yeah.
So The Lion King was released in complete form, so I think there's only like, what, 20 minutes of score on the... Not even. I think it's like 15 minutes of score. Mm-hmm. So it's some good stuff, but I think this is like the first time. Yeah. What, was Stampede originally released on the original?
I think so.
I don't think it was. Was it?
I thought it was.
Well, it doesn't matter. Anyway, so I mean, I'm not sure whether you're familiar with the Legacy release, because I think you're talking about the listening experience of the 94 release.
Yep.
Compared to, yeah. Okay. So yeah, you get the complete score on the Legacy version. And the sound is improved. I find that there's a bit more dynamic range in the original recording compared to this one. And this one is really beefy. The volume is up, but it's far more compressed, like the way Hans Zimmer produces his albums. But you're right. I mean, technology has improved over the 25 years since the original one. So of course mm-hmm. it's going to sound, mm-hmm. Better. I mean, when you hear the first notes of that opening track, it's just like, wow, it's amazing. And I'm wondering whether they're using the original vocals as well.
I don't think
because
so.
I was doing a comparison, and I watched some of the concert footage from Zimmer's previous concerts. And I mean, as much as Lebo M does his best to sound as authentic as 1994, it just sounds almost like the same recording. Especially for the beginning.
You're talking about Circle of
really
Life.
It's really iconic. So.
You're talking about Circle of Life, that opening track.
Yeah,
that's what sounds different to me.
Vocally?
Mm-hmm.
He sounds like he's redoing it again. And I think one of the things I notice about it is that he sounds like, it sounds like he knows it so well that he's just free to just kind of embrace it. And he's just kind of cutting loose with it, you know? As opposed to that first album, he would have been doing that like right now. We got to get this done, you know, straight out of the box. Here's your vocal, go. As opposed to now, he's done it multiple times. And that's how it sounds to me. He just sounds more relaxed as he sings it. It just sounds more, you know, it's different to me. So,
yeah. Yeah. And Stampede is, you're right. It is not on the 1994 release.
Okay. That's what I figured. Yeah.
And I don't own that expanded one. I own several.
Get that one.
I have several of those, but I don't have that one. Of all the Disney ones, I don't have that one.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think like with anything, especially when you're familiar with the original and you start messing around with it. Like, for instance, I mean, I hate to go back to Star Wars, but I was just introduced to this weird clip the other day of them adding this performance added choir to the throne room and finale of Star Wars.
Ooh.
And it was weird. And the thing is, it wasn't the first time it was done. You go down that YouTube rabbit hole and you'll find people adding choir to other cues, the main theme. And it sounds a bit off. But again, I mean, it's a different variation of something that's familiar. So it's whether you embrace that.
Yeah.
I mean, could you imagine if John Williams went back to Star Wars and started adding in a few cuts or even the Imperial March to A New Hope? You know, would people embrace that or would they automatically go back to the original and say, okay, you know, I really prefer the original, but this new one is okay. Yeah. And that might also be why the poll was so skewed towards the original. It's like, yeah, we love the original. The new one's all right. But the original one's that first one, that familiar one. And we appreciate the added music, but there's nothing like the original.
Yeah. I'm full. yeah. I just thought there was more younger people who would have jumped on the 2019 one as if, like, this is the first time I've really heard it, you know? I don't know. I did think it would be closer though, but 3-1 is a pretty, pretty skewed, vote. So congrats to 1994. All right. 94 rules. Listen to me. Let's go on to topic number 3, which is what I've titled Public Composer Pitches. And what I mean by that is when a composer puts out publicly, like on YouTube or on Twitter or on Facebook or wherever, live stream, however they want to do it, and they put out music that they've composed as a pitch to the producers, director of a film or TV series or what have you, to say, hey, here's what I can do. Let me write the score for your big budget movie. And so what inspired this story for today was I saw a tweet. Hopefully I'm not putting him on blast, but I won't name him. Someone tweeted today a pitch for Avatar 2. And tweeted out there, hey, I'd like to do Avatar 2. Here's some music I've written for it. And I thought, interesting. I've not really seen anyone do that, at least not on Twitter before, as a way to get someone's attention and get his music right in their face. I thought it was kind of an interesting approach. So I wanted to ask you guys, and I know you guys know of some other examples of this, so you can bring them up. But what do you think about the approach in general, Dane?
I like it. I think it gives the public an inside view of what goes on in the composing world. I've done it. I have a live pitch that's out there. But
was
I think
it for Avatar,
if I remember,
2?
Yes, that's exactly what it was for.
I was trying to protect
and
your
clearly,
identity, but I couldn't.
I'm here talking to you two schmucks, so it didn't work. No, I'm just kidding. yeah, I think Bear McCreary did this way back in the day. Like, I think he started doing this where he would go into the booth and he'd make a video of it and people would see it. And Brian Tyler's done this now, and it's a really cool thing to do. I don't know that anybody's done it as boldly as the one that was done today, but just flat out said, this is my pitch for, you know what yeah. I mean? But people are doing it and I really like it. I like it because I sit there in every video. I'm like, man, I wish I could be back in the studio conducting live players again. Mm. It's so awesome. And it's also great because it gives us more insight into that world, and the live players need the work. And it reminds people how great our musicians are. It gives people insight into something they're not seeing all the time. And it gives you a great opportunity to speculate.
Yeah.
Oh, it would be great to have that person do Avatar 2. He's so good.
So when you say the people like Bear McCreary and those in the past, were they not as direct? Did they just put some music out there and say, here's an action adventure piece that could be for a female superhero or...
I feel like that's kind of been the traditional way it's been done. I mean, you know, Austin Wintry released an album this mm-hmm. week of his live pitches, mm-hmm. you know, that were rejected. Mm-hmm. But I think that's just great. It's fun to see it. I think it's great so people can understand how much work goes into trying to get the gig, you know. John Williams and Hans Zimmer pretty much are the only guys at this point who don't have to go out there and do something. You know what I mean?
Kino.
There's probably, but look at the films he's getting. They're in the same vein that he's already doing. You know what I mean? So he's not having to pitch because he's not going after something new. Everybody else has got to go for the next thing, get a new gig, right? If they don't have those relationships, they have to make that live pitch. You know, Pinar had to make a live pitch to get to Captain Marvel because she had to prove I can do this. Giacchino doesn't have to prove he can do, you know, a fantasy adventure film because he's done them. I don't know. I guess what I'm just trying to say is I like them. I think they're cool. I don't recall anybody being as bold as.
What do you think about that specifically? That he was like, dude, Jim, check me out, bro. I'm ready to score your five films right now, right here, right now. I mean, how do you feel about that part of it?
I think it's great. I think he put his heart on his sleeve, and I think he really, you know, I liked how he connected it up. James, I've worked with James Horner. I have a connection to him. I have a background with him. He's influenced my life. He's impacted me. I can do this. Let me show you how. I thought it was great.
All right, Eric, what about you? What do you think about this approach?
Well, we discussed this this afternoon, where I said it was kind of overkill, but I guess you do what you can do to get the gig. But then I had some more time to think about it, and I think the only reason that maybe you would do something like this and make it public, not so much the exercise behind it, but to make it public, I guess is in hope that whatever you're doing is going to go viral. Mm-hmm. And then that's the way it's going to get in front of James Cameron or whomever. Yep. Because I would think that any composer would be, if they have an agent, going through their agents making the pitches for them. But I think that if you get some sort of backing from the public, and I mean, we can go, you know, we could talk about, you know, Zimmer's album, which I think there was for the X-Men stuff. I think there was
a petition.
Thank mm-hmm. you. You know, and that sparked it. And that's why it got released. You know, the interest was there. So as much as I think that a lot of it is overkill, you know, but it does show that you're putting the effort into it. You're dedicated. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that these composers are going for something viral that, hey, yeah, you know what? I saw this great piece of music and boom, you put it out there and you're hoping that someone picks it up and runs with it. And then, yeah, it gets in front of the directors.
If nothing else, if it goes viral and you don't get that gig, maybe you get another one.
Right. And we were talking about Pinar Toprak and you corrected me saying that she did the demo for Wonder Woman. And then rework that, and then that got her the
to be clear, I don't know that for fact. I'm just,
well,
that's my knowledge.
She mentioned in that the Score podcast interview that mm-hmm. she had done it for another movie a few years earlier. And of course, you can figure that she was doing it for Wonder Woman. And maybe that's how she got the job with Elfman on Justice League. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, worked her way up to Captain Marvel. But, you know, she went all out. Not only creating that demo, but doing what looked like a pretty expensive video and getting that all put together and packaged up and
$100,000
the right people. Sorry?
She did spend $100,000.
On the whole thing, like the recording
yes.
and all that.
Yes.
That's insane. And that's just yes. crazy. But yeah, yes. you can definitely, again, I say it's overkill, but you know what? It got her the job. I don't know whether everyone else is going to benefit from that. But we did see, well, I mean, for instance, Brian Rolston, is auditioning for the Lord of the Rings television series. And what he did is he's recorded 5 cues and he presented that all live, from the Hollywood scoring stage. And I think it was a way for them to help promote their new stage. But he did an entire live broadcast of the entire scoring session. He didn't say it was for Lord of the Rings, but if you go through the comments, I guess people who know him is like, hey, Brian Rolston's doing demos for Lord of the Rings. Like, so it was definitely out there. They would cut the mics during certain speeches. And I guess, you know, what he was talking about, what type of feel they wanted for a certain cue and yada, yada, yada. But you could tell this is Lord of the Rings music. So, you know, he's doing live streams. He's booked the orchestra. He's got the contractors. He's got the, you know, his orchestrators, he's got his copyists, he's got everybody in the room as if it was a regular recording session.
Right.
He's packaging these things together. He's spending big money so that he can get Lord of the Rings, whether he will or not. But then he could probably package that and use that for something else. Again, hey, look what I've done already. This is how I pitch Lord of the Rings. Let me pitch you this. And sorry, go ahead.
Let me also mention this, and this relates to Brian's thing, which I happen to know because I've used that orchestra. You have a demo rate with the players. And once you cross over into reproduction, now you've flipped into a new rate. So if you're going to do a demo, doing it live and having it on YouTube, you've preserved it and recorded it, and you're still in the demo rate, and it's just up there live, and it's now forever captured. As opposed to you get that recording and now you got to distribute it. Well, if I distribute it this way, I've got to bump into this new rate and renegotiate, or I've got to do this other thing. So if you have that demo rate, that YouTube option is really a great opportunity to get it out there in a way that doesn't have you redoing it, reproducing it, et cetera, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, here's another thing. Who is going to do what Toprak did and really take the ultimate chance of going broke and spending the $100,000, and if she doesn't get the job, she's done. Her career's over. And it was true. She was finished. She gave it all. I mean, how many people? I mean, I don't know how much the demo rate is. So, but is it in the hundreds of thousands of dollars? Is in, like, what would you say is an average for 5 cues at a couple hours of recording session?
Well, 5 cues, you're into almost 8 hours. I mean, depending on how long those cues are. It's 20
minutes.
Yeah, they
were roughly like 90 seconds.
20 minutes a minute. So if you've got 30 minutes, you're going to get a minute and a half.
And you got union players too, right?
Right.
Yeah. So what about like thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars?
I mean, my 30 minutes was, and these are all negotiable.
Sure.
You know, but my 30 minutes was around, you know, 35, and I got a special deal because it was a demo.
Wow. That's nuts.
35.
I spent $9,000 on video gear and I thought I was going to lose my house. You know what I mean? Like, that's
cool.
but I mean, for me, like, I was just thinking that I had $9,000 and I was like, I was desperate at that point. And it's like, holy crap. That's a lot of money it's not like you're actually scoring anything. You're hoping. I mean, it's a lot of hope.
Well, and then that's why to me, these guys, and the time is up, but that's why to me these guys are doing the YouTube thing, because it gives them an opportunity to capture something. It's very special and it's there forever and it's on YouTube and people can go watch it. Fans of you can go find it and it's there, as opposed to doing, I've got these live recordings and now I can't do anything with them other than submit them for this demo. You can't take and turn them into a music library, for example, because now you've got to flip it over to a non-demo rate, and that changes your pricing.
But do you think this is going to be a trend with the live orchestra? Because I think it's too expensive. Honestly, I don't think it's going to. I think it's nuts because samples sound so good nowadays. And I don't know whether this is going to be something that's everybody's going to be doing.
I'm sorry. If you want to get an A-list gig, if you're a young composer or any composer and you're trying to get an A-list gig and it doesn't have live players on it in your demo, you know, you better have a demo that knocks everyone's socks off.
But you're going to bet the farm on that where you have like a 0.01 chance of getting it?
Let me put it to you this way. You're going to have to calculate that risk, and we're really going over here, but you're going to really calculate that risk, and you're going to have to ask yourself, Pinar Toprak, she bet the farm. It took a while. She won. Right? So was it worth it? She did it. She's still alive. Her business was still going. She's still getting other films. She's still getting other work, and she won. So that was worth it. Is it always worth it for everybody? I don't know. I know for me, with four kids, I had to step back and say, do I really want to spend that kind of money all the time?
Well, no. And that's what I'm saying. I mean, we're talking about you here, right? I mean, I'm not trying to offend you, but you're not scoring A-list gigs. You tried. You spent all that money. You took the chance. I mean, most composers, I think, are going to turn out more like you than they are going to be Toprak, just like I'm going to be working on corporate videos and I'm not going to be the next Spielberg I try.
So there's a couple of other issues, which I made my decision to not do that because I worked for Hans Zimmer in my wheelhouse. Right. I didn't have the network that she had. So she had a little bit more things. She had more chips she could gamble with at the table, you know, than I did. Now, give me a couple years, I'm going to go back out there and try it again when my kids aren't, you know, little and I'm having to, you know, support them as much. So, you know, I'll definitely be doing it again. And I want to do it again as soon as possible. Right. So, but, you know, everybody comes to the table with different chips. And to me, I think this is great. And I hope more people do it. And I do see it as becoming a trend if they're going after big projects like Brian was or the one today.
So. Yeah. And we'll move on to the next. We'll cut the next one in half, probably. Story number four. I'll just say from the fan perspective, I liked what I saw today. I like just the opportunity to see, oh, this person is interested in this gig and here's what they can do. Man, they might be great or no, that sucks. But either way, as a fan, you get to see what could be or what might have been if they go another direction. And that just adds a level of interest. I mean, normally or nowadays, we don't get to know who's scoring the thing until, you know, way down the line, right? They don't want to, for whatever reason, don't want people to know. So I like it from that perspective of, oh, cool, this is what you think this entity or this movie should sound like. And let's see what happens. Let's see if they get the gig. I hope from that perspective alone, I hope this kind of thing continues where the composer is that bold and in your face about it of saying, hey, you director, I want this gig. Here's what I can do. I think that's fun. If it gets them the job, great. If not, well, at least we still got to see a little behind what was behind the scenes kind of stuff in the past. All right, let's move on to number four, which is reacting to another poll that I did on Twitter back on July 23rd, where I asked, and this was right after the San Diego Comic-Con, which MCU Phase 4 film releasing in 2020 are you most looking forward to, even though we don't know who's scoring either of these films yet? And the two choices are Black Widow or The Eternals. And slightly closer than our Lion King poll, but not by much. The Eternals got 68% of the vote. Black Widow, 32%. That's out of 136 voters. We don't know a ton about these movies. We know more about Black Widow than we do The Eternals at this point in time. But, Eric, did this result surprise you at all either?
No. I really have no opinion on the matter. It's so hard for me to be excited about anything MCU. And oh man, did I ever enjoy Endgame? But anyway,
yes.
I really sorry.
Why doesn't it excite you then? If
it because most of the MCU movies are rather flat for me. I only have like a handful that I truly enjoy and that I would see again.
But think it score wise though. Put the movie aside.
It's tough for me to make a decision because I don't know who's scoring. And you know, if Hans Zimmer's on one of these projects, then it's going to sound like that. But then if they bring God knows who on this project, do we even know who the directors are?
Yeah, we do.
Can we get a sense of who might be on?
Yeah.
I think that would help me.
We can
gauge as to whether I'd be more excited for one or the other.
Well, let me give you some of that with I guess the Eternals. We've got, I think her name is Chloe Zhao. Chloe, let me look here. Yes, it is Chloe Zhao, and she did The Rider from a couple years ago. I didn't see it, but it was on a lot of top 10 lists. Film critics top 10
The
list.
Rider.
The Rider. It's kind of it's like a life story, a true story, but it was it was made into a drama. And I think he gets like thrown off a horse and he loses his, I think he becomes a paraplegic and then he starts helping other people, paraplegics and all this. I didn't see it, but I've heard so many people talk about it. I know some of the story points. Anyway, super, super popular with film critics films. Scored by Nathan Halpern. I don't know much about him, but his score for that film got a little bit of discussion. So Chloe Zhao, she's known for that. She's doing The Eternals. I mean, it's just like, I couldn't think of a movie more unlike The Rider than The Eternals is probably going to be. Then Black Widow, directed by Kate Shortland. She hasn't done a whole lot of films. She's done a lot of TV. She's from Australia. But she did do a film called Lore, and that was scored by Max Richter. So
that's interesting.
That puts a little interest on it.
Okay, so I'll say only one thing. I think that this new phase opens up so much musically if the producers allow them to.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not sure how many of these films are going to be interconnected the way that they were when we got to the Avengers. Yeah. But hopefully the fresh voices, the fresh directors, you know, these people who don't normally direct these types of movies are going to bring a fresh approach to the series, to this new phase. Mm. And that since Endgame is over and that's finished and pushed to the side, that now we can hopefully get some memorable themes and have some sort of thematic continuity. Again, I don't know whether these films are going to intertwine or not, but that's what would make me excited for this. Fresh voices, definitely. So whomever they bring in, again, I just don't, I don't have a lot of interest in this. So I think I'll just watch and listen and hopefully enjoy what we get.
Yeah. Okay. Dane, what about you?
If I think about it, I'm more interested in Black Widow just because it's a singular character. Mm-hmm. So I think there's more room for thematic development as a composer, I'm thinking about it. But, and I don't know as much about The Eternals, so, you know, I can't get as excited about it. I miss ScarJo's character. I want her back.
Well, I mean, The Eternals is a big group of like alien demigod superheroes, essentially. And they've been sent to Earth to protect the Earth or do something about the Earth. So it's a big group of characters, as opposed to Black Widow, which is only one. So I'll just push back and say, I look more forward to the Eternals for that reason, because you've got all these characters. So I'm presuming we'll get a theme for all the Eternals, but hopefully we'll get maybe some motifs at least for some of the characters that make up the Eternals. Not something we all get right. a whole bunch of, but I'm interested and expectant of something like that. But it depends on who scores right. it, of course. Well, and like I said, those who voted were on the Eternal side. Although Black Widow could be great. I don't know who's going to score it. Someone mentioned that they expected to be a Henry Jackman type score, which I'm cool with, because I like his scores for the MCU. But people were definitely leaning towards the Eternals. All right, let's move on to number five, topic number five. And that is the news of composer Alf Clausen suing Fox over being fired from The Simpsons. We talked about this back in March of 2018 in Soundcast 6, Volume 6? Let me see. Volume 7. So it's been a while. This story's been out there. Me, Eric, and Kristen talked about it. And so
what year was that? Sorry.
2018.
Okay.
And so now it's been reported on BBC News and elsewhere that after 27 years scoring The Simpsons, he was let go, and he believes he was let go due to his age and some younger bucks being hired in his place. And so he put a suit in against Fox. So I was rather surprised by that news. You know, I haven't heard of something like that happening before in terms of a composer suing a studio. Maybe it's happened, but I can't think of another example. Maybe you guys know of one. So I was a little surprised about it. What about you guys? What was your reaction when you heard the news? Eric?
I think the most interesting bit of info that comes out of this article is not that he was fired. We all knew that he was fired, but it's just why.
Yeah.
And I think we guessed last year as to why this had happened. Why after 27 years, all of a sudden you're just getting rid of him. Mm-hmm. And we all thought, I think maybe we talked about fees or prices, or just the kids are going to be cheaper and they can just crank them out.
He mentioned
they have
it. That's what he said.
Did he mention
it? Yeah, he said they hired younger and less expensive people.
But I had no idea that he had a disability.
I didn't know that either.
And I didn't know that was the main reason. That's the reason. I'm like, wow, because we were all wondering what in the world happened. And it seemed like it was ugly. Mm-hmm. And based on this, of course, yes, it was ugly. I think that's the most interesting part. I mean, when I saw that there was going to be a lawsuit, I was like, well, what does he have? It's like, okay, people get fired all the time. And yeah, you know, the way he was let go was brutal, but man, this is something else. This is something new. And the fact that he's willing to do it now, mm-hmm. I mean, he's taking on Disney, which is just crazy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really interested to hear everything that comes out of this one, because this could be nasty.
Yeah, it could be. Dane, what about you? Will it be nasty? Or will it be nice?
I don't know if it'll be nasty. I don't know. I find it interesting that he waited until the Fox-Disney merger.
Yeah, he's like waiting for there to be this. More money involved. He's like, Disney.
Well, here's what
yeah, that's true.
Here's what I'm actually wondering though: is did he have to sign a non-disclosure, and that disclosure has expired now, and that's what I'm betting maybe part of it. His time has ended, So now he can actually vocalize what happened and he can actually do something about it. So that's part of it. The other thing to note is, what if he's looking at, and this is just speculation on my part, because I would assume he was automatically going to get royalties anyway. But mm-hmm. what if The Simpsons goes on to the Disney streaming mm-hmm. service mm-hmm. and now he's got new royalties to deal with? Could he be doing this lawsuit in order to make sure he seals a deal and his royalties get kicked over to him? Because they could turn around, take all the Bleeding Fingers music that's been written, go back, rescore all those extra episodes, throw them on the streamer, and now they don't owe him a royalty.
Oh, wow.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Insane.
Well, it'd be stupid to do too, but they yeah. could do it. They own it. So if they want to cut costs and they want to, you know, they're only selling Disney, ESPN, and Hulu for $13 now. So yeah, they're taking a real gamble. But I mean, I'm just saying, you know, there's all kinds of things that could be going on that also have something to do with this other than just the situation. And I would say that I'm 100% behind him. I want to see what happens because I support the orchestrator from Beastmaster. You know, he is the man.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I wonder how public this whole thing will be. Probably in the won't. End. It was settled out of court for an undisclosed amount, yeah. and we'll never know.
This is my hypothesis, but you gon' be rocking this. Who you think be topping this? Experiment. And when you get to the solution, you can see that we're pollution to the kids that choose to listen.
All right, let's move to topic number 6. And we're going to be reacting to the recently released Experiments from Dark Phoenix, released by Hans Zimmer. A lot of people were wanting this release for a long time. A month or two.
I was just going to say, like,
I mean, really? People were losing their minds and creating petitions. Where's the rest of the music at? And I was just like, just relax. It'll come. Now it's here. And so Hans Zimmer released it from his Remote Control Productions. It was released on August 2nd. It's about 79 minutes in length. And man, there's some long tracks on that mug. So, Eric, have you listened to it? And if so, what do you think?
Yes, I have listened to it. The first few moments of the opening track, I was kind of digging it. But then I got bored really fast. I like the idea of the album. You know, a concept album based on the film or just releasing demos and in with this type of production is actually quite interesting. And I mean, I liked some of the ideas. I liked some of the melodies. I love the orchestral colors. The voices are wonderful. There's a lot of interesting, coloring going on throughout the whole thing. The thing that's killing it for me, and it really is just what kills me for a lot of these remote control studio scores, it's just the ostinato. That just underlining ostinato just keeps going, keeps just pounding at you, and it doesn't do anything really interesting. And that's where it becomes a wall of noise. It's where it just then you just get kind of lost and that's where I was uninterested, and it got really annoying. And so I started skipping tracks. And so I probably missed a lot of great stuff, maybe, but the running time's insane. And, but I do like the album. I do like these concept albums based on an idea, whether it's a book or a poem or whatever. I mean, that's what classical music is. But I just like that he's sharing kind of the ideas before it became fully realized as his score. I'm not sure why it was this score that garnered so much interest.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm not sure who, with the petition that was released and signed. I mean, I'm not sure whether that had anything to do with it, but who knew about the demos and all that sort of stuff, but maybe it was because of the Man of Steel album that came out, where then he released all the demos. So I was like, Zimmer's got to have demos, so let's release all that stuff. And maybe they were hoping and guessing, and Zimmer's like, yep, I got them. Here you go. Like I said, there are some interesting ideas. I do like the fact that he's brought in like an idea from Interstellar, an idea from Angels and Demons, an idea from whatever the first film from that series is called. The Da Vinci Code. And there's so many different, you know, elements being brought in, which I think is kind of cool. So I'd like to see more composers doing this, or at least releasing these things. It's kind of interesting to hear how they, the thought process behind the composition. But as for listening experience, it really doesn't work for me.
I like that first track, even though it's 17 minutes long. It's sort of like the Man of Steel 20-minute long sketch that he does. It's like the best thing out of all of Man of Steel is that 20-minute sketch right. that he does. I really like that this 17-minute one. And then there's a couple of tracks here and there that I like throughout. But overall, I agree with you. It gets a little tedious, and then it gets a little abrasive at times. And I'm just like, in the end, I think I prefer the score that was released, aside from that 17-minute suite that's on the first one, or on this new one. So I'm glad it's out there, mostly just so people can be happy that it's out there and they're not crying about it not being out there. But I'm glad that he does this. It's reported he pulled this from 16 hours worth of music that he had written.
That's bananas.
It's like,
I believe it.
Did you look at the film that you're writing is for? It's like, why did you invest so much time?
That's a valid question. I shouldn't be complaining about it, but because
anytime a composer wants to invest that much time, there must have really been something inspiring for him to go to those lengths. I mean, something was inspiring. If you've written 16 hours of score for any project, let alone The Dark Phoenix, which was a fairly big failure. So this is a very interesting thing. Dane, what did you think about it? What do you think about this release?
I listened to it all today. I liked it. I think it's a great thing to listen to while you're doing something else.
That's exactly what I was doing. Something else.
No, I mean, that's I love that kind of music. I will say this. Hans's work, I prefer his 90s Hans to Hans now a lot. And Dark Phoenix got closer to 90s Hans than he's been for a while, because that melody and the way he kind of wrote it, it's getting back to his old self. And there's a track on this with the electric guitar that's like, I want that Hans back so bad. Mm. But he's so, when he does these sketches, these experiments, he's calling him here, I think that's when you get to hear Hans being Hans.
Yeah, sure.
He's free. He's not scoring to anything, and he just gets to kind of like have fun. And that's why he's pulling in these ideas from these other places, because he's got those sample sets, loops, whatever it is he's working with, sounds, and he's able to pull them in, use them. He knows how to use them. He doesn't have to go, create anything new for that. He's just having fun with his tool set and making something. And I find them very, very interesting. Mm-hmm. As far as the 16 hours, he pulled it from 16 hours. I believe it. These guys are having to write for editors that can just throw their music in right away. And they're going, oh, I didn't like this and I didn't like that. So he's just writing cue after cue after cue after cue after cue to give them option after option after option after option after option that can be, music edited in and placed wherever they need to be. Which is a new era that we're living in, right?
Yeah. It's insane. I mean, let's score the picture, please. Mm-hmm. Can we do that? A little bit?
I'm sure he is technically scoring a picture, but you can score a picture. You can score a scene any way you want, and then the director can change. But again, in the editing process now, and Eric, we've talked about this 100 times, is they can edit anything. They can chop something out.
Score to picture.
You want to score to locked picture.
I just think it works a lot easier with Hans Zimmer and the way that he writes than it does with anybody else. Cause he can literally go back and pound it, just piano, put that in and, make it longer, make it shorter.
Yeah.
I'm just, what really impresses me about this, though, is just the production quality. It sounds so amazing. And I don't know whether all 16 hours sound this good. But it sounds, it sounds so unbelievably good. All the voices, the vocals.
Oh, yeah.
Outstanding.
Now, there's a classic case of a person who brings in live people for his pitches.
Sure.
He may not use the whole orchestra, but he's got to have a vocalist in. He hires a live vocalist, and she comes in and lays it down, you know? Yeah.
But here's my question. Are these demos? Are these like, hey, I've got an idea for Dark Phoenix, and I'm going to play something, and here it is. Oh, you like that? Now I'm going to massage that into a cue. Or is this 16 hours of what he actually wrote for the picture, seeing the scene, and this is what was rejected? And now we only have, you know, that's, we have the album, that's the actual score, and now this is just the leftovers that was cut out. That's what I'm interested in. Whether these are the demos, or him just monkeying around for 16 hours.
I think the letters on the sound tracks. I think the letters on the tracks would give us a clue if we knew what they meant.
Yeah, and that's another, like, what?
X-XXXZT. Who knows?
I think that would be interesting to
make it sound
out.
Experimental.
Yeah.
I mean, the sound is fairly close to the original score. You know, after I listened to the experience, I went back to Dark Phoenix. I'm like, you know, it's not like, oh, these were mock-ups and those were the real deal. They sound very similar.
Always sounded as close to the original soundtrack. I mean, you go back to Gladiator, even the mock, that's like, what? They're almost identical.
It's very true.
So I think that's what was most impressive part. Just the production quality is unbelievable. The sound is crazy good. And, but yeah, I just feel it's a bit much. It's a bit much. But I wish more people would do this. It's like getting the alternate tracks, but it's like, man, well, here's the thing. It's like 2 months later, Zimmer's putting this out and he knows he's doing this for his fans. And meanwhile, we're still all waiting for the John Williams prequel scores to come out. Who loves his fans more? But this is for the fans. And that's what's so cool about Zimmer. He understands what his fans want. So I think that's really neat.
Yeah, agreed. It'll probably be something I selectively return to. When I need some focus time for about an hour, that will probably fit the bill.
Yeah.
So good on him. And I hope everyone who is petitioning and all of that, I hope you're happy and are not then going to petition. We want the other 15 hours of unreleased material. Give us the Zimmer cut. It'll tide him over for a little while. All right. Well, I heard the bell. So I think that's going to wrap us up for this edition of the Soundcast. Soundcast 6, Volume 15. As we sign off, Eric, where can people find and follow you?
You can find me on Twitter at SynSound Radio, on Facebook at Cinematic Sound. You can find Cinematic Sound Radio at cinematicsound.net. I am doing my best to get back into doing new shows. I was going to do some today, didn't have the time, but I have other people doing stuff for me. And so Jason Drury is doing a lot of the heavy lifting again. And so check out his interview with Brian Ralston. Part one is up right now. Part two comes out, I think, tomorrow. And that's always an interesting interview. And he's lined up some incredible guests coming up, including, hopefully Lucas Kendall. I think he got Bruce Botnick, so the engineer for Jerry Goldsmith. And Chris Malone, who knows a lot about Eric Tomlinson. So hopefully we can get some insight on that. But he's landing some pretty solid interviews, and he's doing it all on his own, which is great. And so I hope people are enjoying his interview series.
Absolutely. Dane, where can people find and follow you?
When my internet is working, you can find and follow me on you can find and follow me on Twitter at Maestro Dane. You can find me at Maestro Dane on Letterboxd.
Letterboxd.
I still like it to be Letterboxd. Every day they send me an email and I'm like, Letterboxd. You can go to YouTube, find Dane Walker Music. You can search danewalkermusic.com. That's me there too. And I'm in the internet's places. I'm places.
Okay. As long as your internet's up, we can find you.
That's right.
Excellent. You can find and follow the Soundcast at Audio Soundcast on Twitter, or let us know what you thought about any one of these six news stories that we've discussed, or all six if you have that much time. Put on experiments in the background and record yourself talking about your thoughts. Hit us up on email, soundcast@tracksounds.com, or leave us a voicemail on our SpeakPipe widget on our site, which is thesoundcast.com. If you'd like to follow me personally, you can do so at C. Coleman as well. And if you haven't already, please check out our other podcast, The Annotator. As I mentioned earlier, our guests this week are Jim Fowler and Joe Thwaites, who composed the original score for Blood and Truth, which is a PlayStation VR video game. So that's going to wrap up this episode. Thank you so much for listening. Until our next episode, may your internet keep working.